Welcome to Creative Warriors, a community of purpose-driven entrepreneurs, creative thinkers in business doing what we are meant to do. I'm your host, Jeffrey Shaw. Hey, Warriors, I am very excited to have Randy Gage with us today. Prosperity. A word kicked around so much today that everyone assumes they know what it means and how to achieve it. Well, Randy Gage knows a thing or two about prosperity, how to achieve it, how to live it, and how to share it. So welcome, Randy.
Hey, Jeffrey. Great to be on with you.
We're glad to have you here. Let me tell all of you a little bit more about Randy. Randy Gage is a thought-provoking, critical thinker who will make you approach your business and your life in a whole new way. Randy is the author of 9 books translated into 25 languages, including the New York Times bestseller, Risky is the New Safe, which we're going to be talking about today. He has spoken to more than 2 million people across more than 50 countries and is a member of the Speakers Hall of Fame. When he is not prowling the podium or locked in his lonely writer's garret, you'll probably find him playing third base for a softball team somewhere. So, Randy, before you share your amazing insights with us, we want to know more about you, a little more about you personally. So share with us, if you would, what is your greatest hobby or your obsession?
My obsession, hobby's got to be softball, because I'm in a Tuesday league, I'm in a Saturday league, I'm in a Sunday league, I'm on a traveling tournament team, so I'm doing that every chance I can.
Well, knowing what I do about you, I actually thought you were going to say cars. That's got to be a close second, though, right?
Sports cars are a very close second.
I thought so. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received, a meaningful quote, or a favorite book, other than one of your own, that you were to offer to inspire us, and why?
Well, with that, I would go with the book option, and I would say Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, because that was the most impactful book for me in my life of any book I ever read, because it really forced me to look at the philosophy that I live by and recognize what might be incongruent in my philosophy. And I think a big part of my success today is because I do live by a congruent philosophy of life. And I think most people do not. I think most people have a lot of really conflicting, self-sabotage, limiting beliefs, memes they don't even know they're infected with, that so they think they want to be healthy, happy, successful, but they've got a lot of programming against that because they think money is evil, or it's not. They have to be a bad parent to be wealthy, or a bad parent to be successful, or you got to sell your soul for money. So they have all these conflicting things going on. And Atlas Shrugged is really, it's a philosophy, is really what the whole book, of course, is grounded on, the philosophy of objectivism. Someone's starting out and they say, hey, what's the one thing I could do to get myself on track? I say, hey, read that book and do the critical thinking that it takes to have a congruent philosophy of life.
And what is, so then what is your philosophy of life?
I believe that selfishness is a virtue. Like Rand, I believe we do things for selfish reasons, which doesn't mean we're mean-spirited or we take advantage of people or exploit people. But, you know, for instance, my biggest, deduction on my tax returns every year is charity. I do a lot of donations to charity. I do a lot of charitable work outside of the money I give. But I do that for purely selfish reasons, for the happiness it brings me. So, you know, if you say, what's my philosophy I live by, I'd say that happiness is my moral prerogative, and that being selfish and going after my own happiness allows me to do amazing things and help a lot of people and help other people be happy and other people reach success. But it starts at home. It starts with yourself. And that's my whole philosophy is grounded on, is congruent with that, that we each need to have our own needs met first before we can really be of value to the other human beings we're sharing the planet with.
I think that's a really important philosophy, and it kind of fits into the old adage that charity begins at home. And yet I think there's a lot more to that. I mean, in a literal form, like you just said, charity does begin at home. You built yourself a successful business so that you could give to others. But it also means taking care of yourself and building up the life so that you're in a position to be generous.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm curious also, share with us more about, because I absolutely agree with you that there's this way and people say they want prosperity, but they're self-sabotaging it in ways that they just aren't conscious that they're doing. So tell us about some of those internal conflicts and the way that people are sabotaging their own desire for prosperity.
Well, if you're like me, you grew up jealous of wealthy people. So you literally didn't like them or hated them. And being raised poor, I was a middle kid, three kids. My single mother raised us knocking on doors selling Avon. And so we didn't have a lot. We were poor. And, you see these interviews where people say, well, we were poor, but we didn't know it. I always watch those and go, seriously? Because we were poor and I knew it and I hated it. Right. And because I hated being poor, I was very jealous of people who were not poor. And so then when I grew up and I'm working real hard and I'm trying to make money and trying to be successful, I didn't realize I had this subconscious programming that rich people are bad people and they're mean people and they're not nice people. So every time I would in my conscious mind, in my conscious activities, take steps to become wealthy, on a subconscious level, I kept sabotaging myself because I didn't want to be one of those evil, mean, nasty, rich people. And I bet a lot of people listening to the podcast, that would be the big issue for them, that they just grew up. Because we're programmed with that, with books, with TV, radio, the internet, movies, all of the pop culture stuff. It's just, there are just millions of these memes swirling around. Money is bad. Rich people are evil. It's spiritual to be poor. It's noble to be poor. You got to sell your soul to make money. For a company to make money, you got to rape and pillage and plunder the environment and exploit people. And there's just so much of that insidious negative programming that for millions of people around the world, they have this conscious desire to become successful. But the subconscious programming is, if you do that, you're going to have to be a bad person. And you don't want to be a bad person.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. In fact, you say in the book, you say that one of your core beliefs of that our core beliefs in about prosperity were set before we were 10 years old. So is it helpful then to make a connection? Because there's that kind of cliche question, like to ask yourself, like, what were your earlier views of money? I mean, is that in fact really helpful to make that connection?
Yeah, because in that book you're talking about is the book, Why You're Dumb, Sick, and Broke, and How to Get Smart, Healthy, and Rich. And it's the holistic view of prosperity, health, happiness, relationships, all of that kind of stuff. And I think all of those core beliefs, meaning all the important beliefs in your life, your beliefs about money, God, religion, marriage, relationships, health, they're all formed usually by the time you're 6, 7, 8 years old. Your parents are fighting all the time. You have a view of relationships. If your dad cheated on your mom, you have a core belief about what marriage is like, right? If you're raised by alcoholics, if you're raised in an abusive environment, you have a core foundational belief about love, about relationships, about family, all the key stuff. The same thing with money. If, they were telling you, we may not be rich, but at least we're honest, and money doesn't grow on trees, and, look what he had to do to get that, or I wonder who he had to kill to make that money, and, all of that negative programming we get. So, yeah, think about when you were a kid. What were the shows you watched? Because, of course, in that book, which you've read, that I can look at any age bracket you are, whether you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever. We can look at the pop culture shows of your day, whether we're talking about the Beverly Hillbillies and Think How Rich People Were portrayed there, or MASH, you know, and remember in the 70s, there was always one rich guy in the tent who listened to opera and was pompous and buffoonery, and you know what I mean? And we can go forward to House today, or Beverly Hills 90210, or we can look at Melrose Place, or we can look at Dallas or Dynasty. So whatever age group you are, we can just isolate that decade of your formative years and say, okay, what were the pop culture shows and influences of that time, movies and all that? And you'd say, wow, look at how rich people were portrayed. And then you'd probably say, wow, I really did get programming before I was 10 years old that convinced me that it's somehow, and of course governments do this, organized religion does this as well. It's not just the media. So there's a lot of things causing this influence, but this influence comes out as, well, rich people are bad people. And most of us, we don't want to be bad people. When we grow up, we want to think, we'd like to believe we're going to go out and do something positive and the world's going to be a little better place because we were in it. And so if you think that making money is going to make you a bad person, you're going to find ways to sabotage that.
It's really interesting you would relate it to pop culture, and I've never thought about it that way before. And when I started as a photographer, when I started working with a very affluent clientele, I realized that my vision of affluence came from Bing Crosby's Christmas shows. So for me, oddly enough, like, and I think that's why I was so innately comfortable with wealthy people as a way of serving them, because it just felt like home to me. Like Bing Crosby's Christmas shows were the most homey. Everybody had nice sweaters on and they stood around and they sang songs. So right. When I started working with wealthy people, it's like, wow, this is the way people are supposed to live. Look how homey this is. So it's really, really interesting. I've never heard anyone make the association to the pop culture in which we grew up in and how that influences our opinion as well.
So and now with the internet and social media and satellite TV and 24-hour cable TV, it's more pervasive than any time in human history.
So then what was it, or was there a turning point for you where you really got it, where you decided that you wanted to have a different view, you changed your mindset, which then set you on the path of this massive success that you've seen?
Yeah, I was 30 years old, and I been struggling to make a restaurant work, and the IRS came in and seized it and auctioned it off for tax liabilities. And so I had no house, no car, no job. I was $55,000 in debt, which at that point in my life might as well have been, you know, $50 million. And I just, everything broke down. And I just realized, you know, I don't want to live this way anymore. I got to change. And I looked at all these failed relationships I had and all the health challenges I was having and all of the business failures I had. And, of course, whenever these things happen, it was, you know, my ex, and it was the government, and it was the economy, and it was the president, and it was my crooked business partners. But finally, after 30 years of all this, I finally said, you know, is there one person who was always at the scene of the crime? And I didn't like the answer that question brought me, but that was the answer I needed to get to. Because then I realized, okay, I'm a co-creator in all of this ignorance and this trauma and drama and dysfunction. I am a co-creator. And if I want to change my results, I'm going to have to change who I am. And I began, the process of that.
Okay. And so how do you, gosh, I have so many questions about that, because there's, I love the topic of prosperity, and so often, ultimately, the answer is much more spiritual and inside. And yet there's obviously a very practical action steps that one needs to take to achieve prosperity. So how do you address, because I've had this conversation with people who do feel that they're taking personal accountability. They're owning the fact that this is the position that they're in. The debt is their fault. How do you get them to change their mindset? Because they may be taking personal accountability. They just don't know what to do next.
Well, the first question I would ask, are they really taking personal responsibility, or are they just owning their victimhood?
Right. So I was interested. I was curious is that if that's what you might say. So even if they believe, sort of like the division between consciously wanting prosperity and subconsciously sabotaging it, there's a way in which perhaps they're saying that they own their accountability, but they're not demonstrating that they're owning their accountability.
Yeah. So example, last week, we're talking about pop culture. I'm a hopeless romantic, which always shocks people, but I am. So there's this show on ABC, I think, The Bachelor, and some season is a Bachelorette Bachelor. Well, I never watch it. Well, I just, for whatever reason, said, I'm going to watch it and see this, you know, let's see romance develop. Maybe this will be fun. Because I don't watch a lot of TV. I'm pretty much appointment television for the reasons we've been talking about on this podcast, that I'm very sensitive about what I kind of programming I allow into my world. So I watch it, and there's this, you know, and you, I'm sure everyone knows the setup. There's 10 or 12 women, and they're all competing to be picked by this Iowa corn farmer to be his wife. And he's a very handsome, dashing young man, and you know, they're all beautiful women who want to, and everybody says they want to fall in love and live happily ever after. And there's this, so I watch it. So first time watching it last week. And then there's this woman, and she says, she gets all upset in the middle of the show. She says, he hasn't heard my story. I haven't had one-on-one time with, I think his name is Chris. Chris hasn't heard my story. My story is I met my perfect husband, and we fell in love, and he was perfect, and we had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun and everything. And then he was walking to work one day, and he dropped dead. And that's my story. And Chris hasn't heard my story. And then she snuck away and knocked on his room door so she could tell him her story. And then they are interviewing her, and she, yeah, do you hear my, and I'm watching this, and my skin is just crawling, because I realize this poor woman is just owning her victimhood. This story that she's just wearing it like a badge of honor. And I don't say this to be mean-spirited or snarky or ridicule her in any way, because you know, I have nothing but compassion for this woman. But it was very saddening to me, because I realized whenever we get into any challenge, when it all comes down to decision time, here's the ultimate decision every one of us is going to make in every scenario. Do you want to be a victim, or do you want to be a victor? And you have to choose one, because you can't be both. You can be a victim, or you can be a victor. And I realize as long as she's, you know, holding on to this story, and then that's what happens. At the end of the episode, she like faints and has a panic attack, and the EMTs are coming, and she's mumbling about her story. And then, so I picked it up this week and it picks up there. And I just turn it off and said, well, I can never watch this again.
Well, it's interesting you said. I mean, it's interesting as you're reciting that story that she would think that story is actually going to win the guy. Like, that to me is the disconnect. Like, that's probably not going to work really well. It's a tragic story, but it's probably not going to work well as far as achieving her goal.
But we love to hold on to our tragedies.
Yeah, interesting.
And we love to be the victim. And what I learned for the first 30 years is, you know, because I've been shot in a robbery. I've lost my business to the IRS. I've been in the car accidents, you know, more failed businesses. I mean, if you want to do the victim thing.
You got it down.
I can out-victim just about anybody. And you know, and when you do find someone who can out-victim you, because, you know, you're telling them the story of the tumor you just manifested, and then they tell you a meteorite just landed on their garage, and now, you know, you're really pissed off because they got a better tragedy than you do. But once you stop and you analyze that, you say, wait, no, I don't think I want to have a better tragedy than anyone else anymore. I think I don't want to be a victim anymore. Yeah. I think I'm willing to let go of being a victim, and I'm going to respect and honor that tragedy that happened to me and learn the lessons that it brought me and be grateful for the growth and the development and the lessons that came from that tragedy, but I'm willing to release it now and allow myself to accept my abundance.
I love that. So the first step, if you will, of on the road to prosperity is to make a choice. Are you the victim or the victor?
Yeah, love, and it means that. You've got to be one of the, I have another book called The Seven Spiritual Laws of Prosperity. One of them, my favorite one, is the vacuum law of prosperity. And the basis of this, what I would call a universal law of the of being, is that the universe is inherently good. I know bad stuff happens and earthquakes and tsunamis, but inherently, those are all necessary things to nurture the planet and grow the universe. And, you know, I get that we get into car accidents and we have horrible things happen sometimes. And sometimes horrific things happen to wonderful people. That's all part of the game. But inherently, I believe the universe is good. And when we create a vacuum, the universe is going to fill it with good because nature abhors a vacuum. So if you walk along the beach here in San Diego in the sand and, you know, you leave footprints, the tide is going to come in eventually and fill them. If you're in Chicago in the blizzard and you go walking in the snow, the same thing. The wind is going to fill in the footprints you left in the snow. The universe will always, it abhors a vacuum and will always fill it. And I believe it'll fill it with good. So, but you've got to be willing to let go of what you're holding on. In other words, you have to create that vacuum to attract the good. So if you're holding on to the negative, dysfunctional, abusive relationship, you're never going to meet Mr. or Mrs. Right because you're still holding on to the negative thing. And, you know, if this poor woman on that TV show is holding on to the story of her tragic, you know, loss of her last husband, I don't know how she's ever going to attract the future husband.
I love the concept of
to let that go.
I love the concept of the vacuum. So tell us more. Like, what are some of the positive steps so we can let go of what we might be holding on to? What are some positive steps we can do to create a better vacuum?
You got to do some critical thinking. You got to say, okay, now let me go back and really look. What are my core foundational beliefs on all those important things? Sex, money, marriage, relationship, God, religion, government. How did I learn them? When did I learn them? And do those beliefs serve me? And if they don't serve you, if you believe that, yeah, guys are just abusive and they take advantage of women and that's what relationships and marriage are all about, that's a belief that doesn't serve you. So you're going to need to eviscerate that belief and replace it with a more empowering one. If you have the belief that money is bad and rich people are evil, that's a belief that doesn't serve you because it will always prevent you from becoming wealthy. And it's, you know, and I get people are going to say money doesn't buy happiness. I get that. But poverty doesn't buy happiness either. Okay, what money and material things do is they allow us the self-expression, which allows us to be happy. So money, material things are wonderful tools for creating happiness in our lives. So we got to look at those beliefs, find the negative beliefs we have, which are causing us to sabotage ourselves. And then we have to replace them with empowering beliefs. And then we've got to bolster that with daily programming. You got to be reading books like mine and Wayne Dyer and positive stuff that's empowering you with strong positive beliefs that reinforce those positive beliefs. Sorry if there's a little noise. It's a gorgeous day here, and I'm not that far from a fire station. So.
Well, I'm actually jealous because it's, you know, here in New York where I'm broadcasting from. It's freezing cold, and I'm visualizing the windows being open, and that's why we're hearing the sirens. So yeah, I'm jealous of your San Diego weather. But I'm going to think about that as a positive vacuum and just take it in as sunshine because the windows are open.
Yeah. I mean, it's gorgeous here today.
So let's talk then. Yeah,
so now you want to put that positive programming that reinforces it. And for me, I believe it's daily self-development time that you got to do every morning. Reading positive books, listening to audio podcasts like this, videos, you know, meditation, prayer, exercise. You got to be, because all of, you know, 99% of the TV you're going to watch, the magazines, newspapers you're going to read, the crap you're going to see on the internet, the social media streams that you're connected to, most of it has the negative programming. And you have to counter program against that.
Yeah. If it's not negative, it's at least dumbing you down. That's for sure. So let's talk then about Risk is the New Safe, your latest book. What I found fascinating about the book is that it's both precautionary and optimistic. Not easy to do. So, and you mention a lot of reasons why playing it safe will not work in the future. So I'd love for you to share with us some of the changes in the world that caused you to write this or motivated you to write this and led you to believing that risky is the new safe.
Well, my entire world blew up when a puppy licked my face. And the reason my entire world blew up is because that puppy was a clone. And that was the most earth-shattering experience I had ever been through. Because like you and like most of the listeners, I mean, I'm aware of cloning. I heard that they had cloned a camel or cloned a sheep. And, you know, but this is like Petri dish test tube stuff. Whereas I was holding this puppy, which was a clone, and it was the most adorable, loving puppy like you would rescue from any humane society. And when I realized this puppy had been created in a test tube from DNA, and I realized what that meant for the world and what's going to happen with cloning and ultimately human cloning and the transplant situation, biogenetic engineering, 3D printing, mobile apps, social media. The world is changing. We're going to go through this next decade is going to be the most cataclysmic decade in human history. And all the rules have changed. All the things that used to work in marketing and business and relationships and all those rules are going to change because, you know, if you're if Jones and Sons Hardware can just clone more sons, why would they ever hire outside workers? What does that do to the labor market? If you're a cloned brother and you have seven identical cloned brothers at the Thanksgiving table, what is that conversation about? If North Korea can clone 4 million soldiers, how does that work at passport control and driver's license renewal? And, you know, if men and mothers and fathers go into the doctor's office and they're pre-ordering designer babies with their eye color and hair color and temperament and paying extra for the Maya Angelou poetry gene or the Joe Montana quarterback gene, or, I mean, it's like, you know, when artificial intelligence surpasses all acquired human knowledge, you know, how do we convince the machines not to enslave us or kill us? I mean, we're going to face the biggest decisions in the history of humankind, and most of them are going to be in the next 10 to 15 years.
What I found fascinating, though, I said it's there was a precautionary nature to it. Like a lot of this can seem really scary. And yet you do a really good job at embracing them. In fact, at a point in the book, you say that you believe that the future will be, this is like right now is the greatest time to live in history.
It is the greatest time in the human history to live. It's the greatest time in human history to create wealth. It's going to be the next 10 years. You know, in January, my next book will come out, and it's titled Mad Genius. And it's about how to think like an entrepreneur. An entrepreneur as artists. And it's kind of a sequel to The Risky is the New Safe book, because I'm picking up some of those themes of artificial intelligence and 3D printing and biogenetic engineering and where they're going to take us for the next decade. And getting back to the real essence of your question, which is the challenges those developments are going to create, because, of course, every one of those challenges is going to offer a corresponding opportunity.
You also, it's interesting that without having you reveal too much about the new books, we won't talk about the current one, but it sounds like you've picked up from something, as you said, it's sort of the sequel to Risk is the New Safe. You make a comment in Risk is the New Safe that that creativity will be king and ideas will drive that creativity. And I loved that, and I wrote it down because I love any time we see people in support of knowing, as I believe also, I call it the new renaissance. Like, this to me is the movement of the new renaissance that we're entering into, when creativity is king. And the creative entrepreneurs, which is my community of creative warriors, we're the leaders. We're the leaders of the future. So it sounds like, in a way, that your book, the new book, has picked up off of that thought, that creativity will be king.
Absolutely. Because look at entrepreneurs. Every entrepreneur is going to tell you, I need more money. That's my problem. I have a money problem. I need investors. We need money to do this. But they don't really have a money. Or even people who are not entrepreneurs, right? They're working at a job and they're struggling, and I don't make enough money, and my boss is too cheap, and I can't get ahead. Nobody has a money shortage. What they really have is an idea shortage. Because if you have the right idea, you will attract the money. There are billions and billions and billions of dollars and pounds and pesos and euros and yen and rubles all over the world, billions and billions and billions of them, desperately looking for the right place to be invested. In other words, all these people with all this money, and there's a lot of it, they don't want to put it in a bank account and earn 3%. They're looking for something they could invest in. They're looking for the right idea. They're looking for the next Twitter, the next Uber, the next Facebook, the next 3D printing thing, the next social media site, the next whatever. Those are ideas, because that's, if we wanted to get really metaphysical and go back to Charles and Myrtle Fillmore and Charles's book Prosperity, which he wrote, 1903 or something like that. He talked about how we can, however you believe this universe was created, that we're surrounded by prosperity in the ethers all around us. And the mechanism we use to manifest that prosperity into the physical realm is the power of ideas.
It's really terrific. You also spend a fair amount of time in Risky is the New Safe around developing a healthy ego. And I love the way you phrase this, because one of my observations of you, having seen you speak live, is that you own your work and your message better than most. Like, no bones about it. You know what you're good at. You know how you can serve. You nail it. You own it. Not an easy thing for a lot of people to do. So clearly, you know a thing or two about developing a healthy ego and how that can drive success. So I actually picked up 6 steps in your book that I would love for you, just real quickly, if I can just name each of the 6, I would love for you to just give us a high level view of what each of these 6 steps are towards developing a healthy ego, because I thought it was really valuable. And the first was to direct your ego, sort of like what you're saying, direct your ego to a higher purpose.
Yeah, channel it into something that you want to accomplish, and then you harness it. It doesn't detract from you. It fuels you.
Okay. And the second step you offered was to pursue your purpose with passion.
Yeah, I don't think, your listeners, they don't need any more on that. That's what they do. They get that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely, it's funny. I was giving away a test last year, which people could take, and it wasn't my own test, it was someone else's, and it gave them insight as to how they are perceived by the world. And the results, I gave away nearly 5,000 of them, and more than 90% of my audience that took the test came back, their primary characteristic was passion. So inherently, in the world of creative warriors, you're absolutely right. They're living their purpose with passion. The third step you offer is to think critically and consciously. So maybe you can define, think critically is, we've used the term several times today, but maybe you can help clarify what think critically means.
You got to question the premise, because if the premise is wrong, everything that comes off of the premise is wrong. And there's just so many crazy premises out there in the news and in the governments and religious organizations and pop culture. Again, going back to those pervasive memes that are circulating around the world. And, you know, so if you look at, you know, why did it take somebody who wasn't in the bookstore business to create Amazon? Why did it take somebody who was not in the taxi business to create Uber? Why? Because the people who were in those businesses bought the accepted premises, right? I'm sure millions of taxi drivers and taxi company owners and dispatchers and people thought, well, you know, we could use GPS technology and maybe we could use mobile apps and maybe we could have people rate their drivers and maybe we could automate the payment system. And they all thought, well, but it would cost too much money. It would be too complicated. It would never work. It would have problems with the government, whatever. So nobody did it until somebody did it.
Great example.
Were people who were not in the taxi business.
Yeah, and isn't that the truth? A lot of times, most times, innovation comes from out of the original industry. I think that's a great example. The next step you suggest is to take continuous action.
Yeah, and again, your people, they understand this, but, you know, you can't watch The Secret 27 times and figure your Lamborghini is going to drive itself up into your driveway. It ain't happening. You know, get off your ass and go to work.
Yeah. Although I think one of the hardest things to get people doing, which I'm willing to bet you sort of alluded to, it would be one of your suggestions to gain prosperity, is daily actions. You know, it's one of the, as a coach myself, it's one of the biggest challenges is to get people to get in, to acquire daily habits. Incredibly valuable because it sets the stage for continuous action. So, the next step you offer is to guide your ego through self-discipline. Pretty fascinating. What do you have to say about that?
If you said, what is the one trait that made it for me? It's I'm self-discipline. I get up and, you know, I was in Prague this weekend. I had three different presentations. I got, you know, flew there, red eye flight, don't sleep on planes well. I've got a compromised immune system to begin with. So I wake up in Prague and I've got like a 24-hour flu. You know, I get through my three sessions. I crawl to the airport. I fly home for 17 hours over 9 time zones, you know, and get back Sunday afternoon finally. Monday morning, 6 a.m., I'm back in the gym doing my cardio. Monday morning, 10 a.m., I'm back doing my weight training. You know, I've got my routines. I got my self-discipline. And, you know, that's what, you know, so I nobody would ever drive me harder than I drive myself because I'm self-disciplined. Yeah. And I think all successful people are.
I was just going to say that that's absolutely a common characteristic among successful people is self-discipline. And then last that you offer as a step to develop a healthy ego is to develop a support group.
Yeah, because we all need people who empower us and support us. And then we also need people who check us. In other words, and most people don't have a problem with the last one. They have too much of that. But in other words, you've got to have, and for most people, you're lucky if you could find one or two people in the world who you implicitly trust and you know they love you and want the best for you, and they will always tell you the truth. So they'll let you know when you're off. You know, if you look Michael Jackson was a genius. Amy Winehouse was a genius, but they didn't have anyone around him who would call them on their stuff. And, you know, Charlie Sheen is a genius, but he needs someone who will say, Charlie, no, you know, that's brilliant, but this part here, you're a little off the rails here. You went too far. You know, I remember I was chatting with Larry Winget, who you may know, another a speaking buddy of mine. And he was talking about his wife with his relationship with his wife. And he's saying, I just love her so much because, you know, I can, you know, finish a speech and come off the stage and say, I was really amazing today. And she'll say, no, you were good. But you weren't really amazing today. Okay. You kind of phoned that one in. You know, next time, here's what you could do a little better. And he trusts her and respects her and loves her enough because she trusts him and respects him and loves him enough to tell him the truth. And very few, you know, it's important that you have people around you who do that. I mean, because there's a lot of people who would you'd call your friends, but it's like, you know, when I don't know when I'm going to die, but I promise whenever I do, somebody at my funeral is going to look around at the wherever the funeral is and say, you know, it's funny. I thought with all those followers he had on Twitter and Facebook, there'd be more people here.
That's great. That's great. Right?
Yep. It says, well, I have this many Facebook friends. Well, are they really your friends? How many people in your life really will tell you the truth because they love you and want the best for you? We all need people like that around us.
That's terrific. All right. So, Randy, in a moment, I'm going to ask you our discovery round questions. So while you're preparing yourself for these thought-provoking questions, we're going to hear a brief message, and then we'll be right back. If you're in business doing something you're truly passionate about, my new training and coaching program, The Creative Warrior Unleashed, will rock your world. The Creative Warrior Unleashed is a 7-week program where you overcome the 7 core conflicts that stop creative entrepreneurs in their tracks. I know this journey. I've lived it myself. These are the 7 conflicts that are common amongst creative thinkers and must be overcome to achieve your highest level of success. You'll learn why your so-called lack of focus is your greatest asset. How to create more flow in your business so that being in business is easier than you ever imagined. How to create a clear brand identity so that you are easily found by your perfect clients. And create a diversified business that excites you and rewards you with multiple streams of income. In just 7 weeks, you can gain the clarity that you need for your business success. Simply go to creativewarriorunleashed.com to find out when the next 7-week program begins. The Creative Warrior Unleashed, the path to success for the creative warrior. Check it out, creativewarriorunleashed.com. All right, Randy, it is time for our discovery round questions. Question number 1, what drives you crazy?
People who pander to me.
I can see that. Question number 2. Looking back, what's something that you can't believe you did for your career?
Nothing. I believe everything I did because I was and am willing to pay the price. I'm willing to do what's necessary to achieve my goals. And so I believe everything I did.
That's awesome. Third question is there something in common in everything that inspires you?
Yeah, the stuff that really inspires me is stuff that makes me want to be a better me. It challenges me. It raises my eyes above the horizon instead of thinking, you know, how do I finish this next book to how do I make this next book so thermo-frickin-nuclear that is just people are breathless when they're reading it. And you know what I mean? I like stuff that really challenges me to be better.
Fantastic. And the last question is, imagine you are sitting around a campfire and out of the darkness appears your greatest enemy, which does not have to be a person. What inner warrior inside yourself do you call upon and why?
Just so you know, I would be it would be when Luke Skywalker went in the cave and then, you know, he saw himself in Darth Vader. That would be my greatest enemy because that's, I think, everybody's greatest enemy is our limiting beliefs, you know, our programming and all of the stuff we've discussed today. So my warrior would be the warrior of courage to face my fears. Because I think there's this big misconception. People, you always hear this expression, the fearless leader. And I think there's no such thing as a fearless leader. I think all leaders have fears. But what makes them leaders is they act in spite of their fear or because of their fear. And that takes courage.
Wow. That's awesome. That's so powerful. Thank you. What a terrific way to bottom line our chat today. So, Randy, thank you so much for being here. That's been awesome. And I want to let everybody know that Randy has generously offered us a prosperity ebook. Of course, we'll make that available at creative-warriors.com, where you can not only get Randy's generous offer, but also the offers from all previous guests as well. So again, Randy, thank you for being here. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks. Great being on the Creative Warriors podcast. Love what you guys are doing.
Thank you so much. So that's it for now, Warriors. Let's go out, create, serve, and be prosperous.